Hello and welcome to episode 82 of the National Leprechaun Museum's Talking Stories podcast. My name is Brendan.
My name is Evan.
And today we're going to be hearing the wonderful Paudy tell us all about the fight at the fort. So, without any further ado, let's get started.
The justice of Macha had fallen on the warriors of Ulster. In the time of their greatest need, they were cursed to feel the pains of a woman in childbirth. For reasons never rightly explained, the only warrior free of it was Cú Chulainn. Perhaps it was their heritage. Perhaps it was because they weren't only a man. The Hound of Ulster, the greatest fighter Ireland had ever known. Like a god they were, brave and strong. The armies of Maeve, the villainous queen of Connacht, were marching to steal the brown bull of Cooley, the equivalent of a private jet in today's money. She sent hundreds of warriors against Cú Chulainn, and they all died violently, as effortlessly as you would eat your breakfast. Cú Chulainn held them all back at the River Dee. "Is there no man in the West who can best me?" they said. No reply came, for they were all very frightened. Maeve summoned her council, and she concocted the scheme to end all scheming. She knew there was a man who was just as good as Cú Chulainn, Ferdia, who had trained with Cú Chulainn, who knew them since childhood. But how to turn the man that Cú Chulainn loved so much? How to turn the man that loved in equal measure? Maeve would use the weakness of all Ireland's warriors. "Arrogance," she said. "Status is all they think about. How others see them, how they are seen in turn. That is their greatest weakness." Maeve captured Ferdia and brought him to her court. He refused completely to fight Cú Chulainn. "How can I fight the one that is dearer to me than my own family?" he said. He remembered their youth together and how each golden day had felt, like a day at the height of summer, though summer comes only rarely to Ireland. But then she forced him to drink, and he became very drunk. She promised him gold, riches, and her daughter. And he dreamed about a normal life. Then Maeve said the words that would lead to so much sadness. "They think they are better than you, and so does everyone else." Ferdia took up his spear and ran from the fort in anger. Maeve knew exactly where he was going. Cú Chulainn had spent the night with the woman they had married in a political match, Emer. And on hearing how Cú Chulainn had spent the night, comfortable in a warm bed, while Ferdia was held captive by Maeve, he became angrier still. Cú Chulainn and Ferdia met at the ford of the River Dee.
"How shall we fight this day?" said Ferdia.
Cú Chulainn was heartbroken to see his beloved Ferdia take the side of Maeve. But their sense of how warriors should behave would not let them say anything, only how we have always fought, without holding back. In the frenzy of the fight, each blow blocked by the incredibly skilled fighters, Ferdia cried out, "You are like my servant, my bedmaker, my little shadow. Only because you were so old, so much older than me, one should respect their elders. It never meant anything other than that," Cú Chulainn replied. Ferdia was stunned, and in that moment Cú Chulainn grabbed him by the hair and dunked his head beneath the water. Ferdia broke free, but took time to recover. Cú Chulainn cut Ferdia several times with the tip of their spear, the Gaebolga, spear of legend, unable or unwilling to drive home the final blow. As darkness fell, they kissed each other goodnight, and as warriors of honour agreed to begin again tomorrow. They stitched each other's wounds and applied soothing balms to each other's cuts. Their horses shared the same paddock, and that night they slept beside the same fire. But when morning came, they once again began the work of killing each other. Long and hard they fought, but this day too ended in stalemate. That night they were so heartbroken they couldn't bring themselves to share the same fire again. The following day, Ferdia's age was telling. He felt the cold and the sadness and the weakness.
"Go home to your bone, dog. I have no more time for you."
And Cú Chulainn, sensing that Ferdia had given up, but could not live with the dishonour of living, took up that legendary spear and drove it home through the heart of the man he had loved more than his own blood. When the screams of pain subsided and Ferdia breathed his last, Cú Chulainn took up the body, weeping, wailing, keening. He washed the body and buried him with full honours in a place of great beauty. Sadness and tragedy are common in Irish folklore, but this story stands out above all others, for the two who fought loved each other very much, and they only died because they worried so about what the rest of the world would think.
Well, that was a very tragic story. It has everything. Murderous rampages, vicious queens, violent homoeroticism. What is it about Irish storytelling that makes tragedy so common? Why do we like tragedy so much, do you think?
Just in us, isn't it?
It's just part of the Irish spirit. We just can't be happy.
Yeah, I think as well, tragedy is just a thing. It's very easy to acknowledge, to comment upon, and of course, obviously stories come out of it naturally.
Of course.
Is there more of it than comedy? Yeah. And anything else? Yeah, probably, yeah.
You need to balance out all the comedy with enough death and destruction and general misery.
Yeah, I think as well, you can treat stories like this, as tragic as they may be, with little hints of humour. It always goes a long way.
Exactly,
makes it more palatable.
And I think that's one of the really interesting things about the Tán. The Tán has quite a lot of tragedy, and it's also got a lot of humour and action sequences and mad, insane things going on. Now, for those of you who might be looking at the word Tán and being a bit confused, you might wonder what the Tán is. Well, the Tán is Ireland's national epic myth. It's the great cattle raid of Cooley. And this story that Paulie's just told us, with his incredible retelling, is the fight at the ford. It's right slap bang in the middle of it. Had you heard about it much before joining the museum?
No, the first time I heard the Tán as a title was when I got here. It was first day, and I'm thinking maybe I'm familiar with it or parts of it, single stories that would have been brought to me, I guess, through school, maybe, most likely, but never introduced to me as this is an excerpt from the Tán or this is a story from the Tán.
Yeah, I think that's sort of most Irish people's kind of interaction with the Tán. Most Irish people have heard certain pieces of the Ulster cycle. They've heard about how Cú Chulainn gets his name by killing a dog and then deciding to be a dog for the next few years. They know that this story, it might be one of the most famous ones. It's commemorated in a few statues and artwork, but of course it isn't familiar to everyone. Now, the Tán itself can be a little bit strange to consider because the motivations behind it might be a little bit weird to us nowadays. It begins with the story of the pillow talk between Maeve and Alil when they compare their wealth and they realise they have almost the exact amount of wealth as each other. But Alil, Maeve's husband, reveals that he has something Maeve doesn't have, the Finn Vanach, the white bull. So Maeve decides to steal the down bow, the brown bull of Cooley, to get even with her husband. So it's a war that starts for very, very, very petty reasons and then spirals into something pretty disastrous. Have you any thoughts about it?
Yeah, this thing of Maeve kind of needing to prove herself equal or be equal, especially to, it's Alil, am I saying that?
Alil, yes.
This is her spouse, husband.
Her husband, exactly.
Is that a running Maeve thing or is it something that just props its head up for, you know, the inciting incident of the Tán?
Yeah, it's sort of an important feature of her character, I guess. She's someone who wants to be the best, and at the very least, she doesn't want to be worse off than anyone else. She's someone who kind of needs to prove herself as much as possible, which I guess gives her a lot of quite interesting motivation. Now, of course, the important background going into a myth like this is something called the Curse of Maka, and also the parentage of Cú Chulainn himself. You see, you might wonder, listening to Pádraig's story, why Cú Chulainn is really the only warrior of Ulster who's getting into it. And that's because up until this point, there's been a curse on the men of Ulster, put there by the goddess of sovereignty, Maka, in punishment for the way that they treat her. She prevents them from defending themselves in their hour of greatest need. They make them feel the pain of a woman in childbirth. So, essentially, Maka, have you heard of her before?
I have, yeah.
So, Maka was this ancient goddess, but for a while, she kind of settled down into a life of domesticity with a man called Crinic. But when Crinic boasted about how incredible she was at a feast, she was forced by the King of Ulster to race against his horses while she was heavily pregnant. And when she beat the horses easily, but fell at the finish line and gave birth to her twins, she looked around, saw that no one had helped her, and decided to curse the men of Ulster. Which, I'd say, is probably a fairly understandable punishment.
Yeah, I can really get behind that.
Yeah, Maka just doesn't have a good time. If I was in her situation, I'd be cursing entire provinces too.
And is she still seen as a villain? Or her role in the story is antagonistic?
It's not really. It's kind of an interesting one because in the Ulster cycle, of course, the men of Ulster are kind of the protagonists. Cú Chulainn fights on behalf of them and everything. But this is definitely a situation where we see that the men of Ulster are not great people always. They are so caught up in duty and honour, or they're caught up in the bets they've placed on this race and everything, that they're not helping someone who is clearly in desperate need of help. Now, Cú Chulainn does get spared from this because he's the son of Lú. He's semi-divine and as such not necessarily constrained to mortal curses. Other stories say that the reason that he's spared is that he's not yet fully a man. He's probably around 17 in this story. He doesn't have a beard, which might make him immune as well. Sometimes the wording of the curse is of any man that has a beard. And also, because he's just so incredible, he's able to wage a guerrilla war against the men of Connacht all by himself. He's a little bit of a Mary Sue.
Yeah. Luke Skywalker, what have you.
Now, Maeve is, of course, the central antagonist to this story, described with such brilliant venom by Pádraig. She was the legendary queen of Connacht. Her stronghold was at Rathcroan, which is usually described as a fortress in the Ulster cycle, but in actuality, it was probably more of a ritual site. There's little evidence for it being an actual home place. This lends credence to the idea that she was probably some form of ancient goddess associated with the land and with fertility. Another clue in this is based on the place names, the Dot Island, that are associated with Maeve and her body parts. There is at least two places on this island, both in Northern Ireland, weirdly, that are named after her genitalia.
Okay, all right.
This leads us onto another part of the mythology about Maeve, her sexuality. Her name itself means the intoxicating one. While in the Tawn, she's married to Alil. It's often said she never took a man to bed without having another waiting outside the door. This is probably a holdover from the idea that as a fertility goddess, she'd have been ritualistically married by the new king each time one was crowned. In the context of the Tawn, by this point she's had at least three husbands. The King of Ulster, Cruachan mac Nessa, was her first husband. She had a son with him, but after enduring a fairly toxic relationship with him, she leaves him. Her father then deposes the King of Connacht, installs Maeve in his place as ruler, and then she begins a relationship with this former King of Connacht. Maeve is then sexually assaulted by Cruachan mac Nessa in a series of events we call Cruachan being the absolute worst character. How he's not the villain of the Ulster cycle, I'll never know. And this basically ensures war between Ulster and Connacht. It makes a very, very firm enemy. And her lover is then killed by Cruachan in single combat. She then goes on to marry Uki Dolla, but when he discovers an affair between her and Alil, the chief of her bodyguards, he challenges the bodyguard to single combat and is killed. So finally, at the beginning of the Tawn, Alil has ended up marrying her. She's someone who would have had a lot of partners, basically, in our mythology.
Are all of these partners significant characters outside of their involvement with Maeve, or...?
Not necessarily. Now, this is also possibly just a blind spot in my knowledge about the Ulster cycle. The most important figures there to know are Cahor Mac Nessa and Alil. Cahor Mac Nessa, at the time of the Ulster Cycle, is the king of Ulster. He's the one that's sending Cú Chulainn off into battle. And Alil is important because the conversation between him and Maeve is what sparks the entire ton. The rest, you can know about them, but they're kind of more like trivia than anything else. They don't have as much interesting stuff related to them. Maeve is said to have proclaimed that her husband needed to be without three things: fear, meanness, or jealousy. The last was particularly important, as even apart from being a serial monogamist, she had many, many lovers and affairs on the side. It's possible this promiscuity, though it must be stressed, she's not necessarily more promiscuous than any of the male characters in the Ulster Cycle, especially Cú Chulainn, makes her such a good manipulator. She kind of has this gravity to her. She's able to bend people to her will. She knows what makes people tick, what pressure points to push on to make them do what she wants. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, we get to see a lot of that in the first half, more or less, of the fight of the
Ford. Exactly.
And seems to understand two men very, very well and the interdynamics of their relationship that they're probably not aware of, maybe.
Yeah.
And then uses that against them. Much to Ferdia's demise, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, with that, in many ways, she's certainly a villainous character. She's a master manipulator. She's power-hungry. She's greedy for wealth. But is she any more of a villain than the men of Ulster? Cahor Mac Nessa, in particular, is a terrible person. He assaults her, and then there's the entirety of the myth of Deirdre of the Sorrows, where he essentially raises a girl to be his child bride, and then when she runs off, hunts her and her husband down. What's your take on him?
I can't say I can get behind it. It sounds like it makes a great story.
You wouldn't be a
fan. But no, yeah, it's funny. There's a lot of traits for who we consider the typical heroes that are difficult to sort of grapple with and get your head around. But yeah, there's definitely a way of looking at someone like Maeve as maybe less of a bastard in that sense.
Exactly, yeah. I think an important part of this story is how Maeve is able to use arrogance and honour as motivators. Ferdia isn't someone to fight for riches, for land, for the love of women. He's only honour-bound to fight when Maeve insults his reputation, telling him that he's only afraid of Cú Chulainn and that everyone else knows about it. Now, I mean, that's all well and good, but like, is reputation that important to you? Would you murder your best friend if someone said you were weaker than him?
I think if it meant so much to me at the time, which I'm imagining it would have, this idea of status and warrior status and that probably being related to masculinity and being a man, whatever sense or definition they have at the time. Yeah, maybe, but like in a contemporary sense, it probably wouldn't mean that, would it? It would just be like, you know, it's hurting someone's ego and diminishing them. And this guy has lived fairly closely to and probably in the shadow of a much greater warrior his whole life.
Exactly.
It's an easy button to push.
Yeah.
From our perspective today.
From our perspective, yeah. Exactly. Like, I mean, a lot of this kind of revolves around a sort of slightly alien logic for us nowadays. Mm. But of course, this is a time in Ireland when it's very much an honour-based society. It's a time before necessarily a formalised currency in many cases, aside from cattle. It's a time when honour and duty is kind of what's binding everyone together. And also that physical prowess was much, much, much more important than it is nowadays. What makes this myth so powerful, I think, is the complexity of the characters, the complexity of the fight. It isn't a story about Cú Chulainn murdering people in cool ways. It isn't a story with clear heroes and villains. It's a story about war causing two people, two children by our estimate, they'd only been about 17, who love each other. It causes them to fight to the death. It's all a little bit Hunger Games-y when you zoom out.
Yeah, you're only saying it there. Like, they're 17, they're young men. It's so easy to forget that when you're reading it, and especially when you're visualizing it as well. It's not talking about what we kind of picture in our heads as 17-year-old boys.
Yeah.
Boys being the key word there. You picture two men who've been, probably you're feeling, been through something like this before, even though maybe they haven't. This is really the first time it's meant as much, despite all the great things they've done prior.
Yeah, this is very much, in our context, this is two guys who haven't done their leaving cert
yet
being forced to fight to
two
the death.
Two baby boys with a weapon in either
hand. Two children.
That's it, yeah.
One thing that's very interesting about this fact is Cú Chulainn and Ferdia are almost perfectly matched in battle. And it's no wonder. They met when they were studying under the great shadowy one, Skáhawk, the warrior woman who lived in the Isle of Skye. She taught them both her secret arts of combat, turning them into the incredible warriors we see in this myth. Cú Chulainn is able to slaughter the other men, warriors of Connacht with ease. He holds entire armies at bay while the rest of the men of Ulster are fully incapacitated. It's him against a tide of warriors. But despite being able to cut through everyone else like butter, he's well matched by Ferdia. In fact, he's about to kill Cú Chulainn when Cú uses the gay bulaga. It's a very Cú Chulainn thing to get the upper hand right at the very last moment. In many ways, these are kind of like the superheroes of their time, and in Cú Chulainn and Ferdia's case, they even have superpowers. So Cú Chulainn, of course, has the Riastrad, where he basically turns into an early medieval Incredible Hulk, where his warp spasm seizes him, his body swells in size, he becomes incredibly muscular. He has the gay bulaga, the barbed spear that is thrown by the feet, that when it goes into someone explodes into thousands of shards, so it has to be cut out of them rather than just taken out. Not a particularly nice thing. And then Ferdia isn't a normal warrior either. I don't think it's touched much on in Pádraig's retelling, but sometimes Ferdia is described as having horned skin, which kind of makes him like, if Cú Chulainn's the Incredible Hulk, Ferdia's the Thing. He has a powerful skin that is utterly impossible to penetrate with any weapon, which makes it so that it is very nearly impossible to cut him down. And in addition to that, he's got the help of being able to anticipate all of Cú Chulainn's moves. They've trained together for so long.
Can the gay bulga pierce his skin?
It does indeed. We'll get onto that in just a moment. In fact, that brings us on to one of the most important themes of this myth, the homoeroticism.
Ah, yes.
The gay stuff. They're not necessarily just friends in this myth. Cú Chulainn and Ferdia are described as being closer than brothers. They speak at length in the text about their love for one another. They even shared a bed while they trained at Skáhawk's Island, and you don't really need to extrapolate much to consider that they might have had a gay relationship. Irish mythology does have a fair bit of gay stuff, to be fair. There's the gender-switching fairy magic in the lay of Cabin Dawson's Kesh. There's Fionn MacCool being raised by two foster mothers. It's perhaps not too much of a stretch to assume something homosexual is happening in this myth as well. Even the battle itself is quite homoerotic. They fight for the entire day, and then they patch each other's wounds, they share each other's foods, they even sleep in the same bed, back to back. Of course, according to many tellings of this myth, even the death of Ferdia is on the questionably homoerotic side. Ferdia's skin is impenetrable to all weapons, so Cú Chulainn is forced to impale him. He sticks the gay bulaga into Ferdia's anus, where it explodes into thousands of barbs and kills him, which is a fairly gruesome way to die, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, and quite the image as well.
It's a very strong image.
I'm thinking how conscious it would have been as a queer image.
Exactly.
For the time, because obviously, you know, we get so far into, you know, our time and that becomes very obvious, but would that have been, you know, would it have been as easily seen as a euphemism as it would be today?
Not necessarily clear. Now, this is a time when the people who'd have written down this myth originally would have been Christian monks, and as such, they'd have been people who were familiar with what went on in ancient Rome and ancient Greece, cultures that, while I wouldn't go as far as to call them progressive, they were not progressive, they hated women, they still had a much more accepting view of male homosexuality than we do today, even though even that had its problematic implications at the time. So they'd have been familiar with these methods, essentially. One thing I find really interesting about this, if you wanted to draw a parallel to modern media, is, have you ever seen Kill Bill?
Oh, have I seen? Yes, of course I have.
Of course. I think the end of it is very, very similar to the end of Kill Bill with the five-finger death punch. All the anger dissipates the moment the killing blow is stuck. So the moment Ferdia is finally dead, or about to die, his death is assured, Cú Chulainn immediately becomes friends with him once more. He brings him to the other side of the river so his friend can die in lands not occupied by Maeve. It's a pretty tragic story. What would you say this myth tells us about war?
Well, I think it looks at war to what we were talking about earlier, the idea of masculine status, warrior status, and things like that. There is this sort of be-all and end-all code that all the men seem to be obliging their entire life by, which isn't a wholly terrible thing. It gives them a craft and discipline and purpose, you know, but it is ultimately the thing that makes them both incapable of walking away from this fight, which they both know they probably don't want to have.
Exactly,
as much as one's being coerced and one's being pushed up against a wall. And again, like, you know, it's all about manly status and masculinity, but they're boys.
Yeah.
And this is what, you know, the history of war is a lot of. It's sending young men to die in the name of something greater than themselves and anything they could probably even hope to understand at that age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of fascinating for what is quite a warlike, honor-bound society to have myths that are often quite bitter about war, that show things like relationships being forced to break down purely, not even because they're on opposite sides of an ideological war. Both of them see what's happening. Neither of them want this to happen. But it's just honor and duty and kind of responsibility and arrogance that makes the two of them, against their wishes, have to duke it out.
Yeah, you get two options, and it's death or glory. And
exactly.
There's nothing in between.
And then, of course, I think the most tragic part about the myth is possibly the fact that all of this happens in Louth. I simply do not think I would be able to handle dying in Louth. Have you travelled in Louth much? Is this a nice place to die?
Yeah, I've spent quite a lot of time in two towns in Louth, and it wouldn't be my first choice.
Wouldn't be my first choice either.
But the Spirit Store in Dundalk is class, so let's just shout that out, yeah.
Okay, go to the Spirit Store in Dundalk. And with that, very strange note, I think we're at the end of our little discussion about this incredible myth, about the fight of the Ford, this possible crowning achievement in the Tarn with all of its pathos and incredible stuff going on. Yeah, I think we're nearly at our end. Do you think we're at our end?
I think we've cracked it, yeah.
We've cracked it.
I've learned something.
Mythology solves.
Yeah, we've done it.
Thank you very, very much for listening to the National Leprechaun Museum's Talking Stories podcast. My name's Brendan.
I'm Evan.
And you listen today to Pawdy Holly's retelling of Fight at the Fort. Tune in next time. Thank you.